Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Coffey. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to God and Alcoholics Anonymous for my life and my sobriety. And life is good today. And I was talking to Bob. I want to thank Bob for inviting me out, and Joe and Tony for taking the ride out. You know, Little Rock's out near Palmdale. My home group is the High Desert Big Book Group in Palmdale, California. And if you're ever in town, we meet on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday nights at 8 o'clock, and please come and see us. You know, call central office, you'll find us listed, you know. And I love it. I love coming to Las Vegas. I was talking to Bob about detoxes, you know, in the Antelope Valley in Palmdale, Lancaster, there's no detoxes. Just the idea of being able to go to the detox centers on a regular basis like this group does is a tremendous service. And you know, I wish we had something like that out in our area. We've got a lot of hospitals and institution work, and I'm involved with that. My sobriety date's January 1st, 1990, coming up, if I stay sober for another week or so, I'll be celebrating a birthday. I'm just grateful that to have another sober holiday season, you know, because prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, especially those last 3 or 4 years of my drinking, it was Halloween to Valentine's Day was a blur, and the holidays were there was no fun in the holidays, you know, it was a constant party, and I'm just an alcoholic that loves to drink, I grew up in Southern California. I come from a long line of drunks, Irish, Italian, and Cherokee Indian. And, my dad had 6 brothers and 2 sisters, and we've just got a long line of boozers in our family. You know, drugs and alcohol just ran rampant in our family, and I was no exception. So when it came time for me to pick up my first drink, you know, it was already there, and it was already in place. Growing up in the area that I grew up in, we lived in the San Fernando Valley, we moved out there when I was in 1966. I was 8 years old, and my dad bought a home there. And it was my dad, my mother, and my little baby sister. You know, my mom gave birth to my sister in 1966, and it was about 3 months after giving birth, and we just moved into the new house, and she suddenly passed away. What happened was my dad had a job that he wasn't around much for. You know, he worked for NBC News, and he was always on the go. And so he moved my grandparents in, 2 of my uncles and 1 of my aunts into the house. And they were all about drinking, you know. A typical morning for me, you know, I grew up going to Catholic school. A typical morning for me would be to get up and get ready to go to school. And my grandfather and my Uncle Denny were at the kitchen table at 6:30 in the morning playing cribbage, drinking Old Forester and Slits. I'm sitting next to them, you know, eating Frosted Flakes, you know. Alcohol was just there. It was always my job as a kid was to take the glass out of Grandpa's hand, the Old Forester, and the cigar out of his mouth when he'd pass out in the chair. And, you know, it was just, you know, so by the time I started to drink, I got 2 cousins, you know, one's a year older than me, one was a year younger than me, and we were the coffee boys, and we ran that San Fernando Valley, and we went to those, you know, we just tore it up, and it was a lot of fun. It was my drinking back then was all fun, you know. It was going to those open kegger parties every Friday and Saturday night, and heading out to the beach, you know, and passing out on the beach. We used to be able to have big bonfires at County Line Beach, and we'd just pass out there after the keggers every weekend, it was a great time, you know. I was sober about 60 days, and I heard Cliff Roach talk, and when he made that comment about one of the 20 questions should be, have you ever come to with the roof of your mouth sunburned? It's like the first time I ever bursted out laughing in AA, and I related to that, because I can't tell you how many times I come to passed out on the beach on a Saturday morning, and the families are there, and they're like, just get away from the man, you know, and I'm, you know, it's 11 in the morning and I'm just out, you know, I'm bright sunburnt, my face is chapped, you know, and none of my friends are around, and it's just me and a bunch of empty bottles, and I don't know what, you know, and but my alcoholic life had become the only normal one, you know, and so when I first heard that from Cliff, it cracked me up. I had to, you know, I related to that, and you know, I grew up in a time, you know, with it was in the late 60s and the 70s, and there was a lot of, you know, just a lot of partying going on, and it was the lowrider car clubs, and it was the big kegger parties on the weekends, and you know, in the area where I grew up in, you just go up top of Reseda Hill and you look over the valley and you see these helicopters and you knew that's where the parties were, and you would just go to follow the line of helicopters, and you could always find me near the keg, you know, and I don't know, it was a lot of fun for a lot of years, and you know, growing up like that, my dad wasn't around much, you know, and I had pretty much free realm of whatever I wanted to do, and I had an uncle, my Uncle Jerry. He was 4 years older than me. He's my dad's youngest brother, and he was my idol, and he was like he was the guy that I looked up to, because Uncle Jerry was cool, and he was in the lowrider car clubs, and you know, he would get myself and my cousin Kirk and my cousin Gary, we would wax that car of his and shine those Kreger rims. We'd do anything to hang out with Jerry, because Jerry had all the cool things going on, you know. He had the girls, the lowrider chicks with the ratted up hairdo and the mini skirts and no underwear. And, you know, we were just, you know, we were 13 years old, and if we could just sit across the couch from one of them girls with no underwear, you know, we would just be, we were in, you know. And Jerry would, you know, let us ride with him and cruise Van Nuys Boulevard, you know, and you know, we'd clean that car up of his, and he'd put us in the back seat of that lowrider car, and he'd go pick up some girl hitchhiking and say, you know, if you don't at least try, I'm going to beat your ass, you know. And so it was a lot of fun. I don't know. You know, it was just, you know, but me and my cousins, we ran that valley together. And, you know, I was always the chicken one of the bunch, you know. You know, I was a guy that got a job at 14, and I've always been working, and I've always had a habit to feed, and I always never wanted to be without money because I love to drink, and you know, typical time we'd find, you know, we'd be going to the grocery store, and my cousin Gary would be taking 2 half gallons of tequila and running out the front door, and, you know, my cousin Kirk would be in the back shoving filet mignons down his pants, and I'd be in line, you know, buying corn on the cob or something, you know, and I had the getaway car out in the parking lot, my old 62 Ford Falcon, and anyway, you know, it was a lot of fun drinking. You know, Jerry was the first one to ever get us drunk, you know, and ever get us high, you know, my uncle, and I'll never forget that. You know, it was old English 800, and it was warm, and it was Saturday morning, we were watching cartoons, and he gave us some of that old English 800 and a bag of some of this stuff he called Acapulco Gold, and we just sat there and smoked that stuff and drank that beer and got the munchies and went to the store, and I got my first case of paranoia. I knew everybody in the store was watching me, and I just got, you know, that paranoia came back to haunt me later on in my drinking career, you know, but I don't know, you know, you know, Uncle Jerry was a big influence in my life, and those two cousins of mine too. We partied a lot together. Met a girl when I was 14 years old, and she was 13, and I met at the park where I used to drink, and you know, ended up. Thank you. I like to drink, but anyway, we. I met this girl, you know, and all through high school, she was engaged to get married, and we went to different high schools together, and I was running with the coffee boys, and I was a dog. Anything that I could have an opportunity to, I did, and she thought we were going to get married, and by the time we got out of high school, it was time to pony up and get married, and by this time, I was working at this Jimco department store, and I'd met this other girl, and I got this girl here, and this girl I'm engaged to, and I'm 17 years old, and I don't know what the heck I'm doing, you know, and my Uncle Jerry moved to Colorado and started working for this company, and he called me up one day and said, "Mark, I got a job opening for you at this company in Colorado. Would you like to come out and work?" And I thought, you know, what a heck yeah. So, you know, the girl that was I was in love with is going on the ice capades, and I made this big grandiose plan that we made this plan for her to go on tour in the ice capades, and after about 7 months, by the time she came back, she could come to Colorado and live with me, and I would have all my stuff lined up. And the girl I was engaged to, I just split town. And you know, I just when I'm drinking, I'm selfish and self-centered. I don't care about anybody but myself. And anyway, so I left and moved to Colorado, and I broke that girl's heart, and you know, and started sending that other girl on the ice capades flowers and money and cards and flowers and money at every stop in the ice capades. And God, to this day, I've never heard from her, you know. Funny thing was, when I got sober and moved back to California many years later, and I got a job working at this company, and every day I'd have to walk past her father's little shoe shop. It was right on the same block as my company, and I'd just look over there and wonder, whatever happened to Mary, you know? And, you know, and it was just crazy. But I moved to Colorado and got involved in a business out there that was fueled by drugs and alcohol. And it was a small company at the time, but it grew rapidly. This was in the late 70s, and it was the waterbed industry. And the waterbed industry was booming. It spawned out of the head shop business. Most of the waterbed store owners were ex-head shop owners. Everything about that business was fueled by drugs and alcohol. And I'd sit there with these four guys after work, and we'd drink every night after work and play liar's dice, and this company just started booming. And we were in the wholesale end of it. We sold specifically to the retail stores, and we were in Denver, and it was just, you couldn't sell enough water beds. It seemed like there was a period of time when everybody in the country had to have a bed, and they had to have a water bed, you know, and it was booming. And, you know, early on, moving back a little bit, I have some aunts that were, my dad's sisters, you know, they were really into diet pills. And I've always been a big kid, and, you know, I remember driving them around as a young kid. I was 16 years old, and they were all on welfare and had 9 different doctors, and you know, I had a job, and if I drove them to their doctor and paid for it, then I'd get half the script. And these things enabled me to not pass out, to really drink the way I like to drink, and I enjoyed that. You know, I'm a kind of alcoholic that wants to be present for everything. I don't want to miss anything. I know that something good's going to happen any minute. And if I go to sleep, I just won't, I'll miss it, you know, and I'm the type of alcoholic that I can't go to sleep if there's alcohol left in the house. You know, it just talks to me in the cupboards, and you know, and but those aunts of mine got me, you know, you're heavy kid, you need to try these, and it helped me out with my drinking. So, when I moved to Colorado, though, I was 19 years old or 18 years old, and the bars there, you could be 18 to drink, and I hooked up with this friend of mine, and he was working for us at the time, and he was a drummer in this jazz band, and it was a fusion band, and him and I were like best friends, and we just did the club scene together and lied about our age, and he was playing in the bands, and it was on. Me and Uncle Jerry, we'd just go to the bars and drink, and I became a regular at some of these bars, and then hung out with my friend Dion, and lives in Denver, and you know, and just all you got to do is be around the band members, and there's some perks. And you know, I was just I would carry his equipment, and it was great. You know, it worked out that way. You know, and we drink all night, and I go to work hungover almost every day, but it didn't matter because everybody at work drank like I did. Anyway, the business just did really well, and then they moved, they opened up a new location, they moved me to the new location to run the warehouse, and they moved me out of Denver, they sent me to Chicago. And Chicago's my kind of town to drink in, you know. Chicago, the bars are open until 5 in the morning, there's the blues, the jazz, everything downtown, And man, it was heaven for an alcoholic of my type. They put me in a corporate apartment at 21 years old with a company car and expense account and no bosses. They're all in Colorado. And I'm on top of the world, you know, and I'm drinking now. I'm drinking on a regular basis, going downtown every night, you know, and just hanging out in the clubs and listening to some of the best blues I've ever heard. And just, I just love to sit there and just gel into the music. And alcohol was a, I love to be around people in that stage of my drinking. I love to just get in the middle of everybody and just move and have fun. And you know, and my alcoholism hadn't taken me to that spot where it did later. You know, it was a lot of fun for me then. And I lived in Chicago for about 3 years. And as my alcoholism progressed, you know, I started not being able to function very well because I would go on these binges and I wouldn't be able to stop drinking. And, you know, and I love it so much. I heard Bob share it one time, you know, and it just talked, it's me to a T, you know. Once I start to have a drink, you know, I have never been in that place where I'm drinking and somebody has said, do you want another drink? And I've never been to that place where I can say, no, I'm fine right here. I'm never fine right here. I know that there's always going to be something around the corner. It's going to get better. And as my alcoholism progressed, I started to slack off at work, and you know, but it just, it didn't, no matter how bad I did at work, everybody still bought waterbeds. And the business just continued to grow. It grew like 150% the first year in business. By the fifth year in business, it had grown like 300%. And we couldn't get enough supply for the vendors, you know. And I had a room about, I don't know, I had a wholesale showroom about this size, maybe a little bigger, with about 50 bedroom sets in it, and it was just to bring wholesale customers to show, and I would bring the bar there after night, you know. I would just, let's go party at my showroom, you know. You know, I'm an alcoholic, grandiose. I'm out there drinking and lying, and it was fun though. But as my drinking continued, I could no longer. I started not enjoying my. I started getting to that place where I start to drink and. The obsession for outside issue stuff would come up, and I'd get into some of that, and you know, unfortunately, I do my drugs like I do my drinking. There's never enough, you know, and once I have two or three drinks, there's no such thing as a bad idea. So I just, every night, I swear I'm going to just have a few drinks and go down and listen to some music, and I have a few drinks, and I'm you know, on my way to Indiana or something, you know. And I remember being at a Grateful Dead show at the Uptown Theater in Chicago, and I end up, you know, in Lafayette, Indiana the next morning, and I'm supposed to open up the showroom, you know. And I don't know, you know, it's getting bad, and but the beds are still selling, and so we're gonna open up another location. And they said, Mark, do you want to go to the, you ready to get out of Chicago and try something new? And, you know, in the back of my mind, I need to get out of Chicago. You know, the bars are open all night long, so I'm staying up all night long. So I need to get away from staying up all night long. And I need to get away from drinking all night long. So we opened up a new location in Clearwater Beach, Florida. And they sent me to Florida. And I was there about 5 hours in the hotel bar, and I noticed these two cocktail waitresses kept disappearing in this room, and I knew what they were doing. And I asked them about if they, you know, what they were doing, and the next thing you know, they're partying in my room that night, and I'm introduced to a whole new way of getting loaded, and now I'm in Florida, the capital of it all, and I'm drinking around the clock, but as throughout this is going on, I'm losing the interest of the idea of having fun when I'm drinking. I can no longer, you know, in the beginning, I like to be around people, I like to go to the parties, I want to be around everybody, you know, and now I'm starting to isolate, you know. The book refers to it, and it describes me to the T, and I became disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. You know, I became the lone wolf, and my alcoholism took me to that place now that I could no longer be around people. And I love people. I love being in the middle of the herd. I love being in the middle of the pack when I was drinking and having fun. And now every time I drink, I'm like just getting weirder and weirder and weirder. And, you know, I am just, you know, I'm gone. You know, I got but the beds are still selling. And there's still money coming in, you know, and I'm running a house on the water causeways with these two cocktail waitresses, me and these two waitresses. And, you know, they're getting a little tired of what I'm doing. But anyway, I finally get a DUI in a company car, and in Florida they take away your company car. And by now I'm in sales, and I got to cover a few different states, you know, and without a car it's hard to be in sales. And when you're in phone sales and you're hungover every day and you can't talk because you've been drinking and being up for days, and you know you just can't communicate. And so I can't get there anymore. I cannot get back to that way alcohol made me feel. And you know, and finally in Florida, you know, my solution was to I lost the house. I moved close to my work. And, you know, my alcoholic life had become the only normal one. I'm a big guy, dressed like this, going to work, you know, in August on a 10-speed. And, you know, and I sweat a lot. And, you know, I'm riding a 10-speed to work after drinking, and I got booze coming out of my pores. I smell like booze. I'm sweating. I'm dripping. And I go to the office, and they're like, "What is your problem?" And I'm like, "I don't have a car. What do you expect me to do?" You know, my alcoholic life had completely became my only normal life, and I didn't see anything wrong with it, you know. And I remember, you know, community service work, they put me, you know, they gave me I had to go to the sewage plant and clean the blades of the sewage machine. And, you know, and it's a little steamy in August in Florida, and, you know, I don't know. But anyway, lost that job, lost that job after 10 years of working there. And you know, I started working in the retail business, and anyway, I ended up having to work at this topless bar as a bartender and a bouncer because I was I owed the owner of the bar a lot of money, my friend that I was hanging out with, it was his girlfriend, and. You know, it's a biker clubhouse, and I'm showing up in my OP shorts and my tank top. And I'm just the defiant one, you know, and I don't know, you know. By the time I left Florida, I'd met with, hooked up with one of the dancers there and her 2-year-old son. And, you know, somebody came to me and took a picture of me in my car and this kind of stuff. And they told me that, you know, the debt that I owed was out of their hands, and I knew what that meant, so... Within 48 hours, I was back to California and headed out to California to lie to this girl and told her, you know, let's go out to L.A. and my dad and family live out there and I can get a job working in the studios. And I painted this big rosy picture and, you know, it was all BS and brought her out here and just started drinking again, you know. But those two cousins of mine, you know, those two cousins that I drank and ran the streets with, when I left California and I was 19 and one was 19 and one was 18, my cousin Gary was living in the park. He was homeless. He was, and my other cousin Kirk was making the rounds of all the family's couches. And when you have a big family, it takes a while to burn out everybody. So he was making the rounds, you know. And I got to California with my girlfriend and her 2-year-old son. And by then, my Uncle Jerry moved back to California. So I started working with him again. And I just started drinking just like I did. I thought that if I could not drink whiskey, I'd be okay and just drink beer. And I tried that for a little while, and it didn't work. But anyway, when I got back to California, my cousins said, "I'm having a party, and I want you to come to the party." And I was, like, excited to see them. And I go to this restaurant, and I don't know what's going on. I'm up at the bar slamming down shots of Cuervo, and, you know, and my cousins are all hanging out, and there's about 50 people in the room, and they start singing him happy birthday, and they bring a cake out, and it's got a 5 on it. And he's sober 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never been to an AA meeting. I'd never heard of AA. The people I hung out with, if you didn't drink the way I did, we didn't hang out, you know. And My cousin Gary was sober 5 years, and my cousin Kirk was sober 7 years, and their lives were going good. And you know, my life was in the toilet. And you know, they were the first time I'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and their lives were wonderful. And my cousin Gary just bought a new home, had a beautiful wife he met in AA with a couple kids, and you know, I drank for another year after that, and finally got sober January 1st of 1990. As a matter of fact, I remember moving my cousin into his new home on New Year's Day that of 1990. And at any rate, these guys, if they could get sober the way they drank, because I knew the way they drank, I figured I might have a chance. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous pretty desperate and pretty willing. And you know, I got hooked into a home group. You know, I didn't get into a home group until probably about 8 months. You know, 8 months I was just going to meetings and meetings and meetings. That's all I did, was hang out at the clubs and go to meetings, go to the dances, you know, and go to the coffee shop. And of just going to meetings at about 8 months of sobriety with no program, whatever, just meetings and meetings and meetings, I really wanted to get loaded. I wanted to drink. And my, you know, somebody told me to go talk to these couple of these guys and these old timers and tell them all the things that I was doing in AA. You know, tell them about all of the dances I was going to and hanging out at the club. And I thought he was serious, so I did. And I went up and I told these guys, and I said, I'm going to, you know, 15 meetings a week, and I'm going to the coffee shop every night, and I'm going to the dances. I even went to a convention, and you know, and I still want to drink, and I don't think AA is working for me. And he pulled me aside and he told me that, you know, asked me some questions like, you know, who's my sponsor? And I told him that I use a lot of different people as sponsors. I go to so many meetings and I hear so many good things from so many people. I pick and choose. And he says, where's your home group? And I said, I got about 6 home groups. I go to different meetings all over the place. And they said, what step are you working? And you know, and I read the steps on the wall, and he told me I had an off the wall program. And he basically told me that I was full of crap, and if I wanted to drink, to go drink. Go out there and get it on, he said, you know. He said, but don't kid yourself to think that you ever tried Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous, you never did what's in that book. You haven't even opened that book. And that night he said, get a sponsor. And we went to the Cocos after the meeting, and they said, did you find a sponsor? And I said, I'm going to check a few guys out. I want to come back next week and hear more guys share. And they said, no, he's your sponsor. And they assigned me a sponsor that night. And that night, it was a Thursday night, and they said, Mark, they said, Friday night we go to the Mason and Lassen speaker meeting, and we need a door greeter. You're going to be a door greeter at that meeting. And Tuesday night we have a book study, and you're gonna take on a literature commitment there. We just had an opening. And then on Thursday night we need someone to mop the floors. And on Saturday night, he said, we needed somebody for a cookie commitment. And you know, the thing was that night, I left with a sponsor and 4 commitments a week. And I'm without a shadow of a doubt, I'm positive that if I didn't have the commitments in my life, I wouldn't be sober today. And that embarked on a whole new journey for me. And Alcoholics Anonymous took on a whole new light after getting involved and getting into that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and having a home group and having commitments. And you know, it was it just opened up an incredible amount of it opened me up. And you know, one of the things that happened though in my first year of sobriety is I watched my cousins. You know, I watched my cousin Gary get the big house and the big job and all of the material things, and I watched money, property, and prestige divert him from his primary purpose. And I watched him, you know, drink again and lose his business and his house and his family and become homeless again, you know. And that all happened like I was about a year and a half sober. And my cousin Kirk, the same thing happened. He quit going to meetings, quit sponsoring guys, quit calling a sponsor. He drank again, you know. And unfortunately, his alcoholism took him to that place where, you know, jails, institutions of death, and for him it was death, you know, and he was drinking and had his little daughter in the car and got in a head-on collision, and, you know, he was in a coma for 18 months, you know, and he was like my brother, you know, and we had to watch him for 18 months and then unplug him, and, you know, I don't know, you know, they were examples to me, good and bad, what to do and what not to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, I was active in a home group, and I was sober about a year and a half, and that guy from Denver, Colorado called me up and said, Mark, I'm getting married, and I want you to come be a best man at my wedding. You know, this is my old drinking buddy. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't go to Colorado and be around all my old friends. And my sponsor assured me that if I took Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and if I, you know, I could be a sober member and go there and show up and be an active member, everything would be fine, you know. And it was on my ninth step at the time, and he said, what a beautiful opportunity for you to take this opportunity to go be in that wedding, and while you're in Denver, to go and hook up with the old waterbed boss and talk about and set up a payment plan for everything you stole from them for 10 years. Because I was a thief. I would, you know, towards the last 4 or 5 years of my drinking, half, you know, a lot of the inventory left that facility and went into my partying. And, you know, and I was scared to death, and, you know, to go there and do that, you know, I'm thinking, this is crazy, you know, and, but I had faith in my sponsor, and I had received some gifts in Alcoholics Anonymous by now, you know, I had some faith that things were going to be okay, and, I went to Colorado, you know, and 2 weeks prior to going to Colorado, I was at my home group meeting. It was the Mason Last and Friday Night Speaker meeting, and since I have a commitment there, I got a good seat. Gentleman came up to share, you know, and he's sober. He got sober the year I was born in 1959, you know, and it was one of those first speaker meetings that I was sitting in real close, and where the speaker reached out and got me. He touched me, and his name was Johnny from Long Beach, and I don't know, there was some connection there that I got with him at that meeting, and I never did anything like he did, you know. I'm not the guy that's gone out there and, you know, jumped off of bridges and tried to commit suicide like Scott, you know, last week, you know, and he's a good friend of mine, but, you know, I'm just a drunk that just piddled through life, and but Johnny reached me that night, and I don't know, you know, it gave me a little bit of faith to go and do this thing, and I went to Colorado and went to the hotel where the wedding was at, you know, it's in Boulder, and I get there with all my old friends, and they're having a bachelor party that night, and everybody's drinking, and they're doing shots of tequila. We used to always drink a lot of tequila together, and man, everybody's just having a good time partying, and I'm just like, this isn't crazy, you know, and the guys are in the bathroom, locked in the bathroom. I know what's going on in there, and there's all this booze, and I'm thinking, my head's telling me if I just get loaded, I don't have to make that damn amends. My head's working me over pretty good, but my sponsor had already had me set up a ride to a meeting when I got there, you know, and, you know, I had set up a ride, so I got a ride over to this meeting in Boulder, and I get there, and the cab drops me off, and the meeting is ending, and there's no meeting going on that night, you know, and I hook up with these guys. I tell them I can't go back to the hotel. I'm scared I'm going to get loaded, and they say, well, come with us. We're going to go to another meeting, and, you know, they drove me right back to my hotel, and right across the street from my hotel was the Boulder University, and they pulled into the Boulder University parking lot, and it was a full-blown Alcoholics Anonymous convention. And it was going on right then and there at that, you know, across the street from my hotel. And, you know, and out walks the main speaker that night is that guy that I heard 2 weeks earlier in California, you know, Johnny. And there was just one of those moments that I came to believe that there really was a power greater than myself. And it wasn't him, but there was something that placed me there. And I talked to him after the meeting. He told me to hang out and go to some marathon meetings, you know, go check out the dance, since that's what you like to do. And, and you know, I did that, and I walked back to the hotel that night at 3 in the morning and stepped over the bodies and went and did that best man in the wedding. I was the only sober member, and, you know, it all worked out well. And then my old boss came and picked me up that day, and we went up to his house. He had a big house up in the mountains, and sitting out on the deck, you know, up there, and I let him know about everything I'd stolen, and I needed to set up a restitution plan, and we took care of that old business, you know. And I left Colorado on fire. He said, if you ever want a job back in Colorado, we got one waiting for you. And I came back to California, and I was on fire with these amends now. And, you know, I'm like, this is working out great, you know. And, of course, not all of them were that great, but, you know, I just stayed busy, you know. And I ended up moving out to Palmdale, which is about an hour out of L.A. And, you know, I got a job that I've maintained now for the last 17 years. And, you know, I ended up marrying that girl that I brought back from Florida with me. And, you know, and she got involved in Al-Anon, and, you know, we've got a good life today. And she, you know, I got a son that's just turned 21, you know, a stepson, and he was out here Sunday celebrating his birthday, you know. My wife was telling me that they came out, and she said, yeah, he drank about 5 Long Island iced teas and then got tired. And I said, really? But, I don't know, you know, I moved out to Palmdale, Lancaster, and I was used to a pretty structured meeting environment in the San Fernando Valley. And I came out to Palmdale, Lancaster, and it was like culture shock. And it was, you know, meetings would start 10 minutes after the hour, and the secretary would show up, you know, 3 minutes before, and the coffee would get made maybe by the break, and, you know, just stuff that I wasn't used to. And my sponsor constantly would tell me that if I wanted to make a difference, to get involved. And, you know, I got involved with a home group there, you know, in Palmdale, and I started going, you know, getting involved there. And even though I couldn't stand the meetings, you know, I couldn't stand the people in them or the meetings there, I got involved, and I was an active member of this group, the Palmdale group, for 10 years. And, you know, after about 3 or 4 years of being there on a regular basis and having commitments, you know, all of a sudden the group started to get better. And, you know, and I started to really love my sobriety and cherish it. And, you know, we had a daughter between us, my wife and I. And, you know, I've got a 14-year-old daughter now who's never seen her dad drunk. And, you know, I'm grateful for that. And we live a life, you know. It took her 6 years to get into Al-Anon. And she was resentful at me for getting involved in AA, and she was resentful because I was going to lots of meetings, and I had a lot of friends, and I had people around me, and life was getting better, and she was just like the Dead Sea. It was just stagnant. And then, you know, she finally got to experience her own deal in Al-Anon, and I'm grateful for that, because today our house is a recovery household, you know. And she's got her Al-Anon program, and the women she sponsors, and, you know, and I got the guys that I work with, and my sponsor, and the home group, and we have a very busy life and a busy house, you know. And you know, I remember I was sober, I think it was about 4 years or 5 years sober, and I was working all these crazy hours in this new job I had gotten, and always there about 100 hours a week for a while, and you know, still doing 4, 5, 6 meetings a week, and you know, just juggling all kinds of stuff, you know. And I came down with something called Bell's palsy, and Bell's palsy was like it's almost as if I had a stroke. The whole right side of my face was started to droop, and I had no nerve movement in it. And I remember I just would sit there and I would just slobber, and I had no control over the slobbering, and my face was as if I had a stroke. And you know, and my sponsor, I was embarrassed to come to meetings, you know. And, you know, thank God for sponsorship. You know, I got a sponsor that has a sense of humor, and he said, Mark, I want you to come meet me somewhere. And he said, we need to spend some time together. And I went to meet him, you know, and he put me in his car, and we went to go on a panel, and I'm slobbering all over the place. And, you know, he took me to the Glendale Adventist Nut Ward, and I was able to go into the Nut Ward facility and not be the only slobberer. And I was able to sit there and try and share my experience, strength, and hope with these guys. And I had about 3 guys on Thorazine slobbering with me. And it was great, you know. My sponsor knew that I couldn't save my ass and my face at the same time. And You know, when I first moved up to the Antelope Valley, he made me get out there and get involved in H&I. I told him I'm going to these clubhouse meetings, and I'm getting there early, and I'm there an hour early, and nobody's there, and I'm there, and I'm obviously the new face in town, and nobody, you know, they're at the club, they're playing their pinochle, and nobody's, like, even looking up for a newcomer, you know, I'm going, I can't stand this, you know, he says, well, then here, I want you to get an H&I commitment. And because I couldn't go talk to people. I was afraid to talk to people. And he says, you get an H&I commitment. Now you have a panel. Now you have a reason to talk to somebody. And you go up and ask them if you'd like to go on a panel with you. And that was my reason to talk to people. I'm going. And then he says, whoever doesn't want to go on the panel, you know who not to hang out with. And then all of a sudden I discovered, you know, a whole new way to talk to people. And I'm getting involved in H&I work. And I'm going on these panels. I'm getting to know the people that are active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that whole thing with the Bell's palsy really turned. You know, it lasted for about a year. You know, then it went away. You know, but that year was a rough year for me. But I once I was able to laugh at myself, man, I was like, let's go to the Nut Ward. Let's go to the Nut Ward. You know, I'm ready to go back there. I can go there anytime. You know, where I live in Little Rock, it's about an hour and a half each way to my job, and so I got that 3 hours of commute time and working a lot of hours and going to seven meetings a week, six meetings a week. You know, I'm an active member and in my home group, and I'm just restless and irritable. You know, I remember going to. Calling my sponsor all the time, you know, I can't stand it out here, and I'm coming home, and I'm tired, and I'm angry, and my wife's not doing things right, and my kids aren't behaving, and I'm pissed off all the time, and I come into the house, and I'm slamming things around. This is like at 7 years of sobriety, my sponsor gives me directions that are ridiculous, you know, thank God for sponsorship again. He wants me to pull over at this, you know, about a half a mile from my house on the way home every night, and he wants me to open the door and let God in the car and pull the seatbelt over for God, and I'm like, this is so lame, you know, I won't do it, you know, and I'm still angry and pissed off at home, and then he gives me the most ridiculous instructions ever, and he tells me, and then I want you to, once you got God in the car, I want you to sing to God on the way home, in the car. And he says, I want you to sing Zippity-Doo-Dah. And I'm like, yeah, uh-huh. But there's something about lying to your sponsor, you know, when he would say to me every day, did you sing Zippity-Doo-Dah? And I'd lie to him and say, yes. And he knew I was lying. About the third day, I got God strapped in the car, and I'm about a half a mile from home, and nobody's around, and I'm in the car by myself, and I start singing, Zippity-Doo-Dah, Zippity-Hey, my oh my, what a wonderful day. You know, and I tell you, you cannot sing Zippity-Doo-Dah and get out of the car pissed off. You can't. And I'd sing Zippity-Doo-Dah, and I'd get out of that car, and I'd be laughing. I'd be coming in the house grinning. And my wife was like, what is your problem? You know, the whole house is on eggshells, and I'm coming in laughing every night now because I'm taking sponsor direction, singing some stupid song about Mr. Bluebird on my shoulder, you know, and my sponsor telling me, you know, don't forget, that's God. You know, my oh my, what a wonderful day, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm just... If it hadn't been for sponsorship, I know that I would self-destruct. Today my life is full and rich. My father, I'm very close to my dad, and my dad's 75 years old, and he's about ready to move back into the house with us because he's got cancer. We're in a position, my wife and I, my wife wants to take care of him until he goes, you know, and he's a very, you know, he's very active in my children's lives. All of that couldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Because I was the kind of guy that when I was living in Chicago and I was getting ready to go partying up in the Wisconsin Dells, and I remember getting a phone call from my sister. You know, my sister called up and said, Dad just had a massive heart attack, and we don't think he's going to make it through the weekend. And, you know, I had already started drinking, and so it was as if I could just turn that off. Like, I never got that phone call, and went away for the weekend and came back, and, you know, and then I called home on a Tuesday to see if Dad was still alive, you know, and my father and I, you know, I'm his only son, and, you know, we're very close, you know, and thank God that he didn't die that time, and I was able to make my amends to my dad, you know, and I was able to make things right, and I do that today by being an active participant in his life today. And, you know, I have two sisters. You know, my dad had remarried and married another woman with some kids of her own, and then they had a girl between them, and, you know, the alcoholism runs rampant through my family. You know, one of my sisters won't talk to me right now because she was, you know, she had a 30-plus Vicodin day habit, and you know, she was drinking and doing Vicodin all the time, and you know, finally got her to go to some meetings, and then, the typical thing now for them to do to get them, wean them down off Vicodin is to put them on methadone, and then she couldn't kick the methadone for 2 years, you know, and the only time she decided to get off methadone is because her vanity kicked in and she started to gain a little weight. But the last person she'll come to is her sober brother, you know, and my other sister, you know, she's been struggling in and out of AA for years, you know, and I'm forever grateful that because of sponsorship and a home group that I've been able to have this way of life, you know, and our home group at the High Desert Big Book Group, you know, is that we started a new group 3 years ago. It started 5 years ago with some of us in my home as a book study for the men I sponsor and the men they sponsor. And it grew from there into a regular group. And we have a Monday night book study and then our Wednesday night and our Friday night. And, you know, it gives me a sense of purpose. It gives me a place to be on a regular basis, you know. These guys here that I sponsor that came out with me, they know where I'm at every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you know. And we get the opportunity to try to carry the message. And we bring it, we go into some institutions, you know, there's Warm Springs, there's Lancaster Prison, there's Acton Rehab. And it's just a wonderful thing. My sobriety today is, my job. I did get a job working. My dad got me hooked up to these people in the studios, and I got this job working for this company. And, you know, it's been, it was a small independent company that was bought out by a big corporation, and there's a lot of fear going on, and, you know, they've been cutting jobs all the time for the last 3 years. And I don't know, you know, I just bottomed out on the fear, and I have faith that God will take me through it, you know. And it's been a great trip. And I got friends in Alcoholics Anonymous and I've watched what they've gone through, you know. My good friend Scott, who was here last week, you know, if he can stay sober through some of the stuff he's been through, you know. And my sponsor, Bob Fisher, you know. Bob is, him and I are very close, and, you know, I'm current with my sponsor. And it's guys that walk this walk and do this deal, you know. And today, my daughter and I are developing a relationship that I never thought possible, you know. She's 14 now, and somewhere I lost her between 13 and 14. She wants nothing to do with Dad anymore. Dad's like, not cool, just drop me off at the mall on the outside and get out of here, you know, and make sure that I have a cell phone and a MySpace account. But she doesn't have those things right now, but she knows, her and I are really close, and it's the apple of my eye. It's the joy in my life, you know, and I could never have had any of this without Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I never really got involved in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous until I was a couple years sober, and what really brought it home for me was guys like Bob, that I went to a couple of the book study, the workshop weekends, and there was that guy that I owed a lot of money to, you know, in Florida, and I was 10 years sober when I was in a workshop meeting with I think Bob and Sheldon, and I had felt that the book says that some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and I was traveling 1 year. I was about 5 years sober, and I wrote this guy an honest letter because I knew that the last time I talked to him, my life was on the line. I wrote this letter and mailed it from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, with no return address, making sure that he had no idea where I was at, and it had gone away, until I was 10 years sober and I was in a workshop meeting, and if somebody doesn't bring out the fact that it talks about even the most ruthless creditors, and in 1939, what the ruthless creditors might have been, the loan sharks, the bootlegger, that wasn't Visa or MasterCard. So I've been on a search, and I'm willing now that I've been, I've actually made the effort to try to find this guy. It was just 6 months ago that I got in contact with that woman that I split from, that I was engaged to get married to. We had done a lot of things. She had put herself through a lot of things when I was with her as a little kid, as a young kid. I kept track of her name on the internet, and all of a sudden it popped up, she popped up, with her back to her maiden name. And I talked to my sponsor, and I felt that it was time to contact her and make the amends. And I was able to contact her 6 months ago, and she lives in San Diego, and I was able to meet her and have lunch and make the proper amends, and just to clean up the wreckage of my past and to keep my side of the street clean. And in doing that, my life gets better and better. I'm forever grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and struggling, the book talks about, in working with others, it's one of my favorite passages. It says, life will take on a new meaning, and it's taken on a new meaning for me. And I get to watch people recover, to see the loneliness vanish, to see them help others. And, I can't watch people recover, and I can't see the loneliness vanish, and I can't see them help others unless I'm smack dab in the middle of my home group watching it on a regular basis. If I'm scattered all over different meetings, I never get to see that on a regular basis. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Thanks.